Blog Talk Radio.
Live from the nation's capital, it's Quintessential Listening, Poetry, with host Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram.
Michael Anthony Ingram, welcome to the broadcast. Tonight, our very special guest is Philip John. Philip is the author of the new poetry book, Searching for Seahorses. I guess what I'd like to ask you first before we begin this journey is, what does poetry mean to you?
I think fundamentally, poetry is a language and a transdimensional language. And what I mean by that is, I think that poetry is a channel. It's a channel for the heart and the soul to project a message and a voice, an inner voice, if you like. And I think what's really important is that you listen to that inner voice and don't fight it and prevent that inner voice from projecting what's deep down inside. And I think there can be, as with any art really, there can be a mechanical and an academic foundation in which, you know, you can to an extent learn the craft of poetry. And similarly really to other art forms, whether it be emotionally or physically, such as the martial arts, you know, there are tricks and trades of the language that you can put into practice. You can go to workshops or take courses to understand the various formations of poetry. So the rhyming patterns and enclosed rhymes, irregular, or just free verse. But ultimately, I think all of those things aside, the inner voice is really what poetry is all about, and I think the inner voice has such power to change people's minds, to move mountains really, and to really change for the better. And I think not wanting to use a cliche, but I do think that the pen can be mightier than the sword, and poetry is a perfect way to project that to the world. And you know, I also think the wonderful thing about poetry is that it, going back to my original statement, that it is like a transdimensional language, is that it can transcend the poet and the person who wrote the poem. And what I mean there is that the people who read the poem can take from it something completely different to what was in the mind of the author of the poem, which is, I think, is a great thing. You know, it can mean something so very much to one person, and can mean so much to the poet who wrote it, but they can be two completely different things. And so some of the cryptic nature of poetry also has a very, very powerful effect. And I think what I'll say about what poetry is that I think it is an effective way of channeling some emotions and energy that otherwise almost become become locked inside. And I think every one of us almost has this basement, if you like, inside, where we keep all the stresses and the worries of everyday life sort of locked away under lock and key, you know. And there's only so much room in the basement, I think. I think you have to open the basement and go down and address these emotions. And poetry for me is amongst many other things that I do to channel energy in my life, I think poetry is a perfect way to address some of those, you know, anger and passion. And, you know, it can be positive and negative, and it's a great way to pour out your voice and your inner energies onto a page.
All right. Speaking of emotions, do you think someone could be a poet if they don't feel emotions strongly?
Well, I think it is it is possible. I think to be someone who learns the art of writing, perhaps, and be somewhat emotionally detached from it. But again, I go back to my point about there being a mechanical and an academic aspect to learning a craft and an art such as poetry. But for me, I think being someone who has deep emotions and is intrinsically linked to the work that they produce through a real sense of emotion and energy, for me, that is what is going to create real poetry, as opposed to just going through the motions, which I think you can do if you're if you lack that ability to feel strong emotions. And I don't think you necessarily have to be a person that is emotional on the face of it. I don't think you need to be someone who's, you know, quite dramatic and openly emotional. I think some very deeply emotional people are not obviously so, and I think that they are able to feel strong emotions and write great poetry just as the more theatrical person might be. So I think, yes, it is possible to be a writer and to be a poet, but I think the greatest works really are the ones that are true to their inner voice.
Well, speaking of your inner voice, what was an early experience where you learned that poetic language had power?
So I would say that there were probably two instances that I'd like to answer that. The first is a very, very early experience, and it's really where, as long as my memory serves me well, is the first time I really had an experience with poetry. And it was going back to early childhood. If I remember rightly, I was around 5 or 6 years old. And I was in a school, I was in school and doing an English language lesson. And it was just coming up to Mother's Day. And we were tasked with writing a poem. Obviously we had some guidance from the teacher, and it was part of a wider piece of creating a Mother's Day card with little artwork on the front that we had to draw. And we had to put a poem inside, and we were given some sort of basic guidelines, and I put the poem together, and I remember presenting it to my mother, who read it, and I remember watching her, and she was crying after she read it. You know, I would have thought sort of quite tears of joy mixed with other emotions, and perhaps I didn't fully understand at the time, but it certainly planted a seed, I think, of just how powerful words can be. My second instance where I realized it was quite a powerful tool, if you like, was later in my sort of early adolescence. You know, I grew up in a post-mining valley in South Wales in the UK, which of course saw quite a lot of deprivation after the closure of the mines and loss of industry. You know, as many other communities who faced that thing, that sort of thing would have experienced. And so opportunities were quite slim, and you know, the budget for education and facilities was also quite slim. So the school I went to was whilst it was very, very supportive, it was also a challenge, if you like. And I remember being in a history lesson, and we were learning the history of the country of Wales, and we were learning about some of the Welsh rebellions and so on. And I actually wrote a poem about a Welsh figure called Owain Glyndŵr, who was a leader of the Welsh rebellions against the English rule, which lasted a considerable amount of time and was considerably successful up to a point, but ultimately resulted in a failure to rebel. But Owain Glyndŵr, of course, was body was never found, and although you know, the English kings offered him many pardons, he refused, and he sort of has now become quite a mystical character. And we were tasked with writing a poem about Glyndŵr, and the teacher, who was not really on the best of terms with much of the class at the time, was really blown away by the poem, and every other lesson I remember with him after that point was much different, and I don't know if it was just that poem. It was probably, you know, could have been many factors, but I felt as though it really lifted his mood, at least for a short period of time. And you know, he was quite an old school teacher. He was probably a few years from retirement, and it seemed to have a real impression on him. And I think you know, from that point, poetry was always there then for me. Although you know, I've written more consistently in recent years, it was always something that was played a part in my life every so often. And so those two moments, I would say, were really when I sort of planted seeds that poetry was such a powerful thing.
Oh, wow. Very nice. Very nice. When you think about poetry and you think about your own work, what are some of the predominant themes that you talk about, that you write about?
So I think particularly relevant to my first book, there were quite a lot of social, political, and especially environmental themes, and I really have a strong sort. I really feel a strong connection with the natural world and nature, and I think you know, it's really painful to see some of the mistreatment of nature that goes on in the world. And so I think not just my appreciation of nature, but there are many questions in my work, asking the reader really to question their own behaviors and their own decisions in life, and to hopefully provoke them to think about how the impact of their own actions can have consequences in the world around them. And so I guess in a way, some of my writing in my first book was a little bit, for want of a better word, was a bit constrained to those themes, which is not necessarily a bad thing, because there was a lot of things I wanted to get off my chest about environmental causes and sustainability and those sort of things. But in my book that I'm launching now, which is Searching for Seahorses, I felt a lot more freedom to express my inner voice, if you like. And I think although there was a lot more freedom, some of those themes repeatedly I find inspiration in is sort of maintaining the natural world and doing our bit to look after our planet.
Now, Home Truths is your first book.
That's right, yeah.
So in terms of your books, do you want each book to stand on its own, or are you trying to build a body of work with connections between each book?
Well, I think if you'd have asked me that before I'd put together my first two books, I probably would have said, you know, I'd like to go on a separate journey with each book. But now asking me that question now, when I've completed two volumes of work, I feel as though, in a way, they're able to do both. And I think, you know, each book has its own story to tell and goes on its own journey. But I think that they are intrinsically linked in some of the underlying tones and the themes explored. And I suppose it's a bit of a reflection of my own inner voice in that, you know, I believe that we're all in some way or another intrinsically linked, whether or not we can comprehend what those links actually are. And I think that comes across in the work. You know, there's a lot of metaphysical poems and poems that deal with the big questions of you know, what our purpose is and where which direction we're heading. So I think in answer to your question, they probably will be, in some shape or form, there'll always be a link running through my work, just because of the inner voice. But I also would like to think that each book has its own unique offering.
Right. Where, when, and how often do you write?
Well, I think I'm one of those poets, and it might just be because I'm not compelled to write to make a living at this present moment. But as I know, some people have obviously got to the stage where they're writing as their full time career, if you like. And that's not the case for me. I'm writing from moments of inspiration and really when the moment takes me. So I never feel that I have to sit there and come up with something time and time again. I prefer to let the voices come, you know, the voice come to me. And in that regard, there's been quite an extreme spectrum of occasions where the moment and the inspiration to write has come to me. It has been, you know, sometimes when I've been traveling places. Just last year, I visited the Norwegian fjords, and I was looking out across the lake and across the mountains, and at that moment in time, something inspired me. But then similarly, I've been sort of in the middle of the city riding a bus, and I'll be sort of just doing some people watching and just watching the passers-by, and someone will catch my eye and I'll invent some story backstory that they might be responsible for, and so it's quite varied for me, and so there's never a deadline or a forced projection, and so I hope that really what comes across in my book Searching for Seahorses is really my heart and my soul, and not just an obligation to write poetry.
All right. Does writing energize or exhaust you?
So I would say it does both at different times. So I almost see poetry as an exercise of or a channel, as I said before, of energy. And so the energy levels are, before writing a poem, are very, very high. Similarly to, you know, other things that I like to do in my spare time, whether it be exercising in the gym or going for a trek up along a mountaintop or along the coast. Similarly, you know, I'm energized to go and do those things, and I look forward to going and doing those things, much like I do with poetry. And when, you know, these moments of inspiration, or as I said before, some of the emotions deep down inside when they pour out onto the page. When I'm finished in that moment, and the words have been crafted and placed onto the page, then the feeling of exhaustion comes afterwards. But it's almost not just exhaustion. It's almost a feeling of relaxation and a feeling of calm, much like you would feel after accomplishing something great, like reaching the top of a mountain and climbing back down, and then when you rest afterwards, you might be tired and exhausted, but you also feel very, very accomplished and fulfilled.
Well, when you think about your work, your entire body of work, what is the most difficult part of the artistic process?
So I think with the way I write, it tends to be the moments of inspiration will come about in the form of either a very brief expression, or it might even just be two or three words, or it might be two lines. But that tends to be it. And then I'll sort of make note of that wherever I am, if I can jot it down, or I can write it into my phone or whatever device I've got, just to remember the expression of, or the moment of inspiration. And then I think the more academic and mechanical side of it comes out, then when I'm trying to sort of create this moment of inspiration into the narrative of a whole poem. And so sometimes the moment of inspiration has come up with three or four lines. Sometimes it's simply been a word. So I think the most difficult thing I find is to then sort of draw this narrative out of this moment of inspiration, which perhaps is the bit I find less fun and more hard work. But I guess that's part and parcel of art, really. There is a moment of inspiration, but then there's an awful lot of work that comes along with it as well.
What is the easiest part?
I think the easiest part is probably the easiest part for me, I would say, is those moments of inspiration. They seem to be never ending at this moment in time, and I keep my fingers crossed that those moments will never go away. And there are sometimes, I could go a week or 2 weeks or even a month with no writing at all, and then all of a sudden, 5, 6, 7 or maybe more poems will suddenly manifest themselves, and I just hope that those moments of inspiration will always be with me.
All right, are you very active on social media?
So I would say probably moderately so. I think I am quite skeptical still of some of the elements of social media. I think.
Why so?
Well, I think I've got both positive and negative aspects, I think, of social media. I think the negative side of things is that it does, unfortunately, breed unhealthy competition, and it can have negative impacts on the emotions when, people are compelled to compare themselves to others rather than just taking stock of what they achieve in their own lives. And also, I think, it gives a voice to people who perhaps haven't reached a stage in their life where, or a stage of enlightenment where they necessarily should be the right person to have a voice. I suppose on the flip side, it's good to provide more people who otherwise wouldn't have a voice with a voice. And I suppose you have to take negatives with positives. But from a more positive note, I think it's a fantastic way of connecting with the world, and it provides wonderful opportunities for networking. In that sense, there are positive aspects. I think more of the negative aspects are probably felt when social media is used obsessively, So I think the key, as with many things in life, is to moderate usage and to be selective and use it in the right way.
Right, I understand that. Now let's focus on Searching for Seahorses. Tell me about the title.
So the title Searching for Seahorses is it's multi-layered, really, and it's quite, I think anyway, it's quite symbolic. And the symbol of a seahorse, the idea behind that is that it represents something quite magical, something quite mystical, but also quite elusive. And I like to compare that really to, you know, the things that we are all searching for in life. Sometimes we are looking for, you know, either a particular person, a particular place, or it could be a concept or an idea. And I think, you know, we're all on our journey to search for that, even though at times we question what it might be. And I think the seahorse is quite a good way of symbolizing that. And I also, you know, the seahorse is again one of those species that will find a partner and stay with them for many years on end, and I suppose that is in a kind of a more romantic way of looking at it. It's quite symbolic to you know, many of us as humans are often searching for our soulmate, whoever they may be. And I also think the search for something elusive and mystical can be quite comparable to the ocean, and there are quite a number of poems that within Searching for Seahorses that look at the idea of the ocean as a symbol of the journey of life. The ocean has so many as a vast variety of different moods and different ways it can behave, and it can be one of the most violent and destructive forces, but it can also be one of the most rich, diverse and calming and soothing things as well, which I think is the almost the yin and the yang of life, really. So the Searching for Seahorses is the connection to the ocean, and also symbolic, really, of the journey of life.
Oh, very nice. Very nicely stated. When you think about the book, Searches for Seahorses, if you had to convince a friend or a colleague to read your book, what would you say? What might you tell them?
I think that it wouldn't be right to say that it's going to be for everyone, even though, you know, I very much like to think it is. But I think what can apply to everyone is that each poem, I think, is a journey of its own. And so I like to think that they would go through the book and they would find something that not only inspires but provokes thought, in although in a positive way, but also in a way that might begin to change their point of view, or begin to get them to think about something slightly differently, which I think is a big role for poetry to play in the world, is to encourage people to think about things that in a perspective that they may not have had, or may not have had the opportunity to look at something before. So perspective is a huge thing, really. And you know, I have learned coming from fairly humble working class roots, and, you know, moving to an area perhaps where there are a wider range of people, and people who have perhaps come from parts of the world with more financial privileges and more opportunities. And sometimes offering that, your perspective, to them can be enriching to them. So as well as enriching the language through creative poetry, I think you can enrich people's lives by offering them new perspectives and new ways of looking at a wide range of ideas or issues or subjects.
Searching for seahorses, as it states here, poses further questions about the future we are handed over to the next generation, excuse me, along with some heartwarming poems about love, happiness, redemption, and the journey of life. You also talk about establishing a relationship with nature. Tell me more about that.
Yes, so in this modern world, I feel as though much of society is now very dependent upon technology and, you know, as we spoke about social media, and
it feels as though
people are, you know, plugged in 24/7 really. And, you know, we spend time driving cars in public transport, indoors with electronic devices and so on. And I feel as though, to some degree, people are almost losing touch with that, that primal element, the intrinsic link with nature, which, you know, fundamentally we all have. And I think we all really need sometimes to keep us connected whilst being disconnected. So it's a funny thing, really, that sometimes we are, you know, more connected than we've ever been, but sometimes we can feel a bit disconnected with each other on a one-to-one level. So I guess what I mean by that is, you know, we can be messaging people halfway across the world or looking at the status updates of strangers and people across the world, and yet we don't seem to find time to talk to neighbors or friends or family who are with us in the room. And I think, you know, reconnecting with nature is a great way to reconnect with people as well. You know, if you just go on a walk with some friends and go out into nature, and whether it be up the mountain in the woods or along the coast, and I think we all need that sometimes to refresh ourselves and remind ourselves that you know, there's more to life than just being plugged in.
All right, I agree. We'll be right back. Special guest is Philip John. Philip will be reading from his book, Searching for Seahorses. Philip, you're on.
This poem is about a conversation that you might have with nature, or the contemplation of a conversation that you might have with nature about the way that we as a human race have treated our planet and continue to treat our planet. And this is titled, What Would the Roses Say? What would the roses say if I sat in their meadow and told them about these days, of how the rich man lined the pockets of his purse, and the child without a spoon cried for a cure to the unforgiving curse? Could I talk to the stream that runs in a world apart, and tell it of all the lost souls and their broken hearts? Of how my people turned their backs on the beauty of nature in hope of satisfying their happiness with material flavours? Should I stride to the coast to shed a tear for the sea, or did already have wept on behalf of humanity? They busied themselves with peripheral drama, and on it would go perpetual trauma. Earth, the gift, who could harm her? I think I'll wait for the moon to fill and the night to fall,
and hope that the clouds don't come to call, so I can sit alone beneath the stars. They've seen it all. This poem is titled Delicate Hours, and the essence of this poem really is to encourage us to think about what really makes us rich. And I don't mean the acquisition or the retention of wealth and capital and material things, but rather the things in life that really make us rich. Our relationships, the people we love, our family, our friends, our experiences, travel, our culture, and all of those things. So this is called Delicate Hours. Beyond the boughs that bind our hearts, from springs, the God of all life, streams ebb and flow down through our vale. Watch the lamb as it learns to run, to laugh, and to sing. You just might learn it too, before the end of spring. The grey of winter, howling out its final moon, makes a morning's safe passage for the hare to meet a garrison of flowers yet to bloom. But this, not a promise, life will never pass you by, for it is a precious world of, oh, so very delicate hours. Before the world lives and breathes another spring, count your friends, not the ones bought on an enchanting summer's eve, but the ones who walked with you when the day drifted into a harsh winter's night. And with those friends, lose your worldly possessions, not the honeysuckle or mother's milk, but all the silver, gold, and devil's dust, because in the garden of a precious world, in, oh, so very delicate hours, you are rich enough. This poem is really capturing one of the key themes of my new book, Searching for Seahorses, and that is the quest and the struggle to find a place in this world, in this time, and to find really your purpose in life. But it also serves as an encouraging reminder that your life does have purpose, and that really you just need to keep fighting the good fight and really trusting in your own visions and your own words. And this is titled Ode to a Time Traveler. It's written as an ode, quite a standard ode form. There are five stanzas, each consisting of 10 lines. The rhyming pattern is varied, and so it's irregular rhyming. And this is called Ode to a Time Traveller. 'Twas a painfully ordinary autumn, and the unforgiving rain would not relent. Born under the smiling moon, Wednesday's child of woe arrived, and not a moment too soon. Let me tell you about this man, how he came to his senses from the shallow depths of his unprepared grave to the immeasurable heights of the great beyond, and found himself somewhere in a peaceful bliss within the gift of life. Unaware that the chase had begun from a life already lived, the curse of a thousand suns, so the growing pain of a turning century would turn themselves to face him. Through the veil of time's grand illusion, the lovers and the strangers, they were a warm pool of promise for all the things to come. Life cannot be without its genius, nor without all the unfinished symphonies and the unrequited love. When the moment comes at last, a time for unused wings to fly, the crossroads call like a lost songbird, and the sweet familiar streets are a faded backdrop in the masterpiece. The night's marauders will arrive all too soon, ready like the vultures who feast upon the dead. But for those who live to fight another day, there is the most beautiful gift, richer than all the silver and gold, the unknown stories never to be told. If you've ever been a roamer in a time you do not belong, listen to me. Your struggle is very much like mine. Hear my words in song, hear them all in rhyme. It is not for you to find your place in this forsaken world. And it matters not if your visions are unseen by all about you. Now that they're inked on precious pages, like prophetic scrolls, eternal but unprotected. The callous words like daggers in the soul, they cannot conquer mountains, nor the ocean, banished so truly that their breath cannot be found below its surface. Then do not let them burden you, nor pull your presence to puerile plains. Be free of the weight of widespread ignorance, and your own words will be written, maybe out of time and out of place, but in a perfect nest for transcending great epiphanies that on this earth are revered for eternity. This poem is titled The Ocean, and this poem is really looking at how the ocean compares to the journey of life, the yin and the yang, and you know, the struggles we can face one day to the peaceful bliss that we can encounter the next. So this is called Ocean. If you've seen the surface of the ocean in God-forsaken storms, and sailed a ship through waves that torture the sky, day and night, you will know it is this that serves the sweetness when the salt water sleeps again. Life itself will ride with you, and the tide is an unreachable dream. Let it ride with you. When you feast with the fishermen from foreign lands, indulge but stay humble, and never lose sight of the world beneath, roaring with life, magnificent. If you've seen the surface of the ocean, neath a cloudless sky, serene and calm, and maybe just a little blue, it is only when you take that plunge to the depths, far from the reach of the light of day, that you find a beauty older than anything that rose above. Colours that the soul can feel, a mystery, another way to breathe. So break in and beyond the surface and find yourself an ocean, deep and vast and free. This next poem is a contemplation of the difficulties of beginning in a very difficult situation, disadvantaged, you might even say deprived, and trying to find a way out, and trying to achieve something, whatever that thing may be, in order to create a break in the cycle of perpetual failure and deprivation. And to that end, this poem is called Breaking the Cycle. Born a neighbour to these wretched estates where friends caved in to a drugged up fate, thinkers cannot thrive in the stench of rusty needles and burnt out leaves. Intellect was a disease. If you find yourself so far behind before it's even begun, you start to wish yourself a way of closing the mind to the potential, so you join the party of the existential. I don't care why we are really here, I just want to feel my way through the dark. You know there's a raffle going, but it's not what you were sold, education, the ticket for a ride for the ones so bold. I suppose it's a blessing to some kind of comfort, so you can worry about the ozone instead of the dole. But you still find yourself in a maze of mediocrity, pulling at the strings of the suburban dreamers and their flexible friends. You've climbed every level. Greed and hypocrisy doesn't seem to end. A poetic license doesn't promise you anything that's worth its salt. But maybe this voice, if only for a second, will get the world to stop. Let's take it all back, right to the very start. Show them that there's hope, even if there's nothing left. Maybe we can break the cycle. A platform for those who are next. This next poem is quite a romantic view of an individual's search for companionship and for love. And in that sense, it is written much like other poems in the book. It is written in the style of the Romantic era. And again, it draws from some comparisons to the ocean and the richness of the ocean as a concept. And this is titled The Lighthouse Keeper. The lighthouse keeper is lonely, and oh, so blue. Bluer than a sea that tantalizes the shore, neath the glow of a silvery moon, the crowning light on the waves that rest no more. He dreams of setting sail on an adventure far and bold, that all the beauty here he can no longer behold. The lighthouse keeper is lonely, and oh, so blue. Horizon on the rise, break of day too soon, gulls in a fishing frenzy, ready for a brand new world. Oh, how the lighthouse keeper doth envy them, so lonely and oh, so blue. But then one dark and stormy night, someone comes a-knocking. From beneath the winding stairs, fairest maiden of that humble hamlet, declaring her truest love. For the guider of ships shall take the helm of a vessel more beautiful than anything, anything that the lighthouse ever did see, 1,000 miles of ocean. Ships from far and wide, fishermen from the world over, and all of the life that leaps to the stars, to fall so freely back unto the depths, to be reborn and to live once more. The lighthouse keeper, lonely no longer, and the only blue from the great wide yonder, the lighthouse forever in darkness, but the hearts of these mysterious lovers forever in the light. This next poem is really posing questions to the kind of future that we are handing over to the next generation, and questions really if we need to be doing more to ensure that they are handed over with something that we would like to be handed over. And this is titled The Disciples of Discipline. A sordid drink of ignorance filled the plastic cup, as it fell from the hand of its captor, just as they had fallen from the buried skies of the misunderstood. The centripetal forces play their game so well, and the fall that broke its walls could not break its spell. The countless eyes of unborn children, behind the curtains of the theatre, the cabaret of life. Are the audience unworthy? Do they pass a torch extinguished so many years ago? Or do they carry a burden too heavy for this show? If they, in a century, were awakened from their slumber, would they be happy to starve on Martian soil whilst they watched the dying embers of their burning earth, after all they could have done, should have done? Before this show is over, don't fill another empty cup. Take each other's hands and fill up center stage. The main event is not for saving face. It is each and every tree and each and every man and beast. This is now a poem about returning to home and a homeland and a song about salvation, really, and particularly coming to the end of a season and coming to the end of a cycle and coming home, really. And this is called Autumn. Now the pavements of a loveless town are so far from thine eyes. The time lingers like the cold dew, but fresher than the song of the lark. The leaves are crisp and golden, and the summer that promised tomorrow is buried in yesterday. The lanterns awakened at this strange hour, and the night is here so soon. In a chapel of reflection, a choir of candlelight sings of salvation. A place to rest for those wanderers, returning home at last. With each night that draws in, that man of many faces knows of the tides to come, and he casts his light upon the stars and upon this life. I wrote this next poem in order to channel my frustrations with the way that some people choose to live their life and the way that the sense of self-entitlement and greed and apathy have been bred into society, and this really is a defiance against that mentality. This is titled Macrobiotic Man. I look upon the victims of captivity as they willingly gasp on the noxious fumes of this phosphoric society. Faces covered in a cosmetic seal of pretense, and hearts in mouths, still starving, still climbing Jacob's ladder. Not me. Though time and tide shall weary me, I will be true to my temple, and the spiritual cry of body and mind, consuming that which nurtures my biological machine, and I'll try my best not to harm this earthly green. I know I am, like others, made to be broken, and I cannot be immune to the parasites that perturb my precious present, but I will not be the frivolous snake that planted no trees in his wake for the child of tomorrow's sake. Keep me balanced in this coward's chaos. Keep my light burning, but only bright enough to warm the hands of those who must carry the future, however much is left. This is a poem titled Destroyers, and this is a question to the people who see themselves as the leaders of the world, the people who are ultimately making the decisions that will impact upon us and future generations. And this is putting to them some of these questions and pressing issues of our day, and also potentially exploring some of the consequences of ignoring these issues. Destroyers. Destroyers without the arms to do so, a trophy hunter without a gun, idling in mind's eye. If golden lions do not run from the hissing flame of a killer, then what is there of courage for the scavenger, aside from the rush of blood to satisfy the empty hole of time? See the little man with a rifle and an axe to kiss the pastures. He knows nothing more than his blinkered sight will feed him. It is those who are the sum of their parts that squeeze the zestless lemons until exotic has no definition. When half-buried camels lie dead in the acid snow, and the fossil of a seahorse is just a postcard of slate sending greetings for tomorrow, hold to account those who feel more warmth as their pedestals are within reach of the mortal sun. The cold will soon be with them, for they are too blinded by all that glitters to see the forewarned. It is absolute and almighty, and shall not stop until kings and queens can feel every last fibre disintegrate, burning from the tops of the wounded mountains of hell. All hail the death of the incumbent. The phoenix is back in flight. This song, this next poem is really about appreciating the incredible complexity and wonder of the many worlds that are around us. And there are such great things that we can see ourselves in front of us, whether that be for me, for example, this poem was inspired by a trip to the Norwegian fjords when I was stood at a lake and could see the big green mountains either side, and it was quite a cloudy day, so you had the bits of the clouds just draping themselves over the top of the mountains. And I also got to think that, you know, there's also a world beneath my feet, and you know, the mini beasts in the undergrowth, and there's so much richness of life and diversity of life, and sometimes it's hard to comprehend. And on that note, this poem is titled Perplexed. The density is unfathomable, and the stirring provocation of my limitations do not stop in the welcome of green-robed cliffs decorated with white cotton collars. Crying would only be in the way a child cries when it cannot understand. Nothing can entrap the mind of complex life quite like the immensity of its birthplace. The spells of an ocean's roots are conjured in the contours of a perfect lake, one that requires no upkeep and no unwanted hand. It makes me wonder if the bird that glides forever has eyes bewitched by the splendor of this indifference. So many worlds within worlds, the audience in the planetarium shall not have the time to see them all. This next poem is actually from my first book, Home Truths, and it's an exploration really of my own hometown, and I was in my hometown visiting one quiet weekend really, and I was walking along the hills of home, and I was looking down on down into the valley and at many of the post-mining terraced houses. And it got me thinking about the story behind this place, which does have such a story to tell, yet all was quiet on that day. And so this really is setting the tone of that and is titled In the Suburb of a Dead Town. The lonely streets are quiet tonight, as the moon gladly tells of the times gone by, because he's seen it all, from the birth of the Queen's Rock to the warring of the ancient tribes. But the sleepy houses are tired now in the suburb of a dead town. The rising sun can tell you more of man and boy setting sail for the foreign shore to fight in someone else's war, of man and boy breaking their backs to dig and dig for the diamonds of black, mothers like rocks holding the fort, the struggle for freedom waging on. The place has not lost its voice, but does not speak of the mystery of this beautiful land steeped in history. Nothing left to prove as I walk atop the rolling green hills, staring down in the suburb of a dead town. A further poem from my first book, and this poem really is further questioning of the times we live in and some of the things we take for granted, and some of the things we should probably consider to maintain not just our own future, but the future of our planet. And this is called The Age of Convenience. The age of convenience has brought upon me an increasing sense of worldwide apathy. God is a screen and heaven is in cyberspace. Plugged in but logged off, the system is your saving grace. The world is connected in every which way, except for the souls of a crying generation. Cold from the waves of the sonic boom, all of us out there for a quick fix, expert knowledge, is it really just a click? That on your plate ready in a flash, filling your face with no time to last. The factory slaughtering your hands is profit for the system and profit for the man. Listen to the screaming sound of starvation. Are you still hungry or in need of education? Don't moderate, just medicate, vegetate. Drink it dry and in full measure. Trade future pain for instant pleasure. Living with our heads deep beneath the plains, in goldfish bowls of happiness, it's driving me insane. Keep lighting the fuse that fuels the world, chasing the mirage of happiness in a rainbow of fire and smoke. Melting the lungs and suffocating the ocean, the mother has spoken. You have the answers in the palm of your hands. Take a walk into the wilderness. The birds are still singing to us, and the land is still alive. Fight to break new ground before the ground has broken. Fight to see the sunrise after the final dawn. The age of convenience has brought upon me a time for change and a new frontier. A further poem from my first book, and this really is about reflecting on childhood and innocence and home, I suppose, as well. Home is a very strong theme for the people of Wales and the Welsh culture and so on. There's a word in the Welsh language which is hiraeth. And this word really is translate, if you translate it, it's sort of means nostalgia or a homesickness or a longing for the past, a longing for a time that once was or perhaps never was. And this poem is actually titled Innocence. Untouched by the weight of a heavy world, before the first fatal kiss, in the grand old garden, the closest to bliss. Stood in a street so familiar, the only one that may have ever been. I was lost picking berries, then falling through the ferns in a forever place. Faces I know, I love. They turn with the ticking of the hand. Holy houses fall through the seasons, and I lament. I lament for all that was promised is lost, though it stayed for long enough until friends had flown and wise old mentors had resigned. And as the world around decays, so do people and time itself, but slow enough to savour every ember of youth. Now I have a poem titled Reincarnation. Again, this is from my first collection, my first volume, titled Home Truths. The poem's called Reincarnation, and in essence, this one is really looking at keeping our loved ones and friends and family that have passed on, keeping them alive and keeping their energy alive through our memories. Reincarnation. Rolling, tumbling at the water's edge, black lambs suckling on the whitest sheep, the gatherer of daffodils sheds tears for the travellers as the intrepid move on and the world goes by. Standing atop the mountains where the weeds move upward and the rocks crumble into dust, blown by the wind toward the beaten track, a rusted red gate promises the wanderers of the adventures of the past. Sanctuary found in the fountains of the forgotten, the quiet chords of birdsong floating in the air, and just for a fleeting moment, you were never really there. I would like to finish by reading a further poem from Searching for Seahorses, my new volume that I'm launching this evening. And this really is about a journey that we are all on, regardless of our age, our background, our gender, race, culture, religion, experiences. We all face challenges, troubles, and different obstacles along the way. And I think the real richness and the real enjoyment doesn't necessarily come from the destination, but is really within the journey. And this is titled The Journey. The soul breathes heavy under the weight of expectation. It grows weary, burning out the flame of destiny. In your desperate ruins, what hope is there to set you free? And if not hope, then what? Cradle every last ambition, no matter how small it seems in a monstrous, power-hungry world. Question every thought that manifests and grow them in the greenhouses of your mind. These long and lonely nights can last a lifetime, but carry all the failures, every fear, let them ignite in a glorious fire, let them fuel the burning desire. But stop. The soul must breathe again, to find the balance in the oceans of the abyss, the courage to hold back from the riches, those so far from the helpless, hopeless destitute that you once knew, and live, and love yourself and those that loved you when you did not. They kept your head from falling and the soul from drowning. Longest, harshest roads with so many troubled turns, the ones that started so impossibly, so insurmountable, and in the end it is not the green and golden fields of richest fruit that sweeten the heart, the soul, and the mind. It is the everlasting beauty of that road behind, the world's greatest journey, and it is yours.